Du lytter til Supercomputing i Danmark, et program om forskning, teknologi, big data og supercomputere. Supercomputing i Danmark udgives af DAIC. Din vært hedder Iben Julie Schmidt.
På IT-universitetet i København har man fundet en alternativ strategi til at skabe klogere og bedre robotter. Man efterligner simpelthen evolutionsprocessen, som den foregår i naturen. Det betyder, at man faktisk fremavler robotter, kunstige hjerner og nye, bedre computere, i stedet for at programmere sig frem til dem. Hør, hvordan det foregår, når Sebastian Risi, lektor ved IT-universitetet, fortæller, hvordan han bruger supercomputeren Abacus til at arbejde med kunstig evolution, lærende robotter og neurale netværk.
So my name is Sebastian Risi and I'm a associate professor at the IT University in Copenhagen, and I'm affiliated with the Robotics Evolution and Art Lab and the Center for Computer Games Research. So I have kind of these two different tracks. So one is that we're trying to use AI methods, artificial intelligence, to make computers smarter, but also make robots smarter. And we use a lot of these bio-inspired algorithms. So we're trying to, for example, look at how the human brain works and trying to have a really rough abstraction of this in computers. And we're also trying to borrow ideas from natural evolution. So instead of programming these computers and robots, we're trying to evolve them with concepts from like natural selection, survival of the fittest. So instead of programming a computer, you can kind of breed computer programs and artificial brains. That's kind of the rough ideas. Mm-hmm. But of course, it's much more less complex than what you see in nature currently.
Yeah, your work is less complex, but it still sounds very complex. How do you, I mean, could you tell me what is artificial evolution?
Yes, so the idea is that you try to kind of take the main ingredients what we see in natural evolution and try to use them to optimize things in a computer. And so, as maybe people here remember, natural evolution works by you have a large population and then some things are slightly better at a certain task, and then based on that they have more offspring and then they reproduce more, and over time they get more adapted to the environment. And so we do something similar in a computer. That imagine you want to, instead of having architect making a table, you want to breed a table. So you can decide also on a fitness function, on a fitness, how fit is a table, by saying the table gets more chance to reproduce if it is more stable. So, and then you, initially all the tables you will get will be crooked tables and they will not be balanced. But if you repeat this process over and over again, always choosing the table that's most stable, doing this thousands of times, at the end you have a table design that is stable enough. And you can do this, people use this, for example, for evolving antennas. So that's one of my favorite examples, because they, through artificial evolution, they found an antenna design that worked better than any design that the human made. And that design was actually sent to space a couple of years ago. And basically you start with a very basic antenna, and then through a random process you change, slightly, you bend it in a certain way, and you do this 100 times, so you have a population of 100 different antennas that all slightly different. Then you look at how good are they at receiving transmissions, and then you take the best one and you slightly change again, maybe add another antenna thing, and then again you look at the 100 and you take the one that works best, and by doing this over and over again, slightly changing, mutating the designs and combining the best designs, if you repeat this process, you will get eventually something that's good for different tasks. That's the basic idea behind this artificial evolution. So you have variety and you slightly change things through mutation on crossover, and then over time you get better designs. And you can use this for table designs, you can use it for antennas, but you can also, what we often do is we use it for to also evolve the brains of these robots in a similar process, that you have And oftentimes we do this in simulation. That's also why we need Abacus, for example, that we, because it's a very computational intensive process that you can't really do on physical robots directly. So we have large scale evolutionary experiments. We have an environment that kind of tries to, like a simulation that tries to be as close to the real world as possible, where you have robots, and then you have each of these, imagine 100 robots, each of these robots has an artificial brain that's slightly different. And then again, we want to, for example, evolve them to travel as far as possible. So you take, initially they will all not travel far at all, but one will be slightly further than the other. You take that one, you slightly change their brains by changing the connections in the brain, adding another connection. Again, you take the best one and you do this over and over again. And then at the end, after doing this thousands of times, you have a robot that travels quite far without you having to know how to design a controller for this robot yourself. So the only thing you have to do is design how do you represent the brain of the robot and what kind of fitness do you reward it for, but you don't need to know how do I program a quadruped robot.
Mm-hmm. And this principle, is that you apply that in the development, or do you also want to apply it in the robot so that when the robot's actually in use sometimes it will evolve continually, or?
Yes, so there are two different, so my research actually tries to combine, in Asia we have two different ways of adaptation. So one is through evolution, which of course takes a long time, so it takes generations for animals to adapt. But of course then you also have animals that can adapt like in their lifetime much quicker, like a dog, if it's injured, if it loses a leg, it's able to, you know, after a few minutes it can walk with three legs instead of four legs. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to evolve machines that can then also learn during their lifetime. So we don't just evolve the brains, but we also evolve learning mechanisms that allows them then to learn new things during their life. So they have these artificial neural networks, that's what these simple brains are called. They have, for example, also now we added memory to them. So they can learn and to read and write from an external memory. So similarly to us, they can remember and learn from past experience. So they can write, if they, let's say a very simple task, the robot is born in a world and it doesn't know if red berries are poisonous or good. So to explore, you have to try it at least once to know. And then these robots now have the ability to write that knowledge into like this memory, and then next time they encounter the same berry, they can look, okay, I ate this before, it wasn't good, so I'm not going to eat it again. Mm-hmm. So that's something we're exploring, like combining evolution and what we call this lifetime learning, learning during the lifetime of the machine, of the agent. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you have robots in as which are actually working in real life, or?
Yeah, so we have some, we're working on, we have some modular robots that they don't combine this lifetime learning yet, but they are evolved in a simulation, their behavior, and then we can transfer that behavior to the actual physical robot. And then the next step would be to give them also the ability to adapt during their lifetime. So we have shown that this works in the simulator, but not in the we haven't used that in the physical world. Mm-hmm. Yet.
Are you going to?
Yeah. Yes, yeah, yeah. That's definitely the next step would be to, once now we know it works in simple environments in the simulator, the next big step is to scale up and then try to make it work in the real world, which has a lot of additional challenges, because you can, in a simulator, you're not always going to have all the different factors that influence how good your robot performs. So then you have to also try it in the real world and then see how it works there. But it will always be a combination. Well, for us, it's hard to do all the optimization on the real robot. So what we'll search for these artificial brains in a simulator, and then we're trying to transfer them and then give the robot the ability to, even though the simulation is not exactly like the real world, because the robot is adaptive, they can also learn to adapt to the difference between a simulation and like the real world. That's the goal as well.
Mm-hmm. So is it correct to say that the artificial brains that you are developing is a kind of software you put into a robot? And
yes, yeah. So these artificial brains, or the artificial neural networks, they're basically they're kind of like a graph-like structure. So you have some inputs, which you have sensors from the environment, like how far am I from the wall, you have rangefinder sensors, and then we have this artificial neurons that are very simple compared to real neurons. They're just kind of specific, some function, and then having that goes through multiple layers of these functions, and these neurons are connected also by like synapses. But it's very simple compared to the real thing. But it has what's similar is that you have these multiple layers that it goes through, and at the end of these layers, you have the network tells you, you know, go left, go forward, or go right. Like it reads the decision based on how it's connected, its topology, and that's also what we train through evolution: is how are these neurons connected? How strongly are they connected? Like some neurons might be stronger connected than other neurons, and that's then for evolution to figure out. These connections so that it works well for a specific task.
Will it be able to make new connections itself?
Yeah, so that's also something working on. Normally, often in most approaches, they just get new connections during evolution, but not during the lifetime. But that's definitely something that we're working on. That new neurons are born actually during the lifetime, when the brain kind of realizes that you need new neurons and connections to save more information, then it would create new connections. Mm-hmm. And we did this now with this external memory, that the memory can grow and shrink depending on how much information does the agent need to save. Mm-hmm.
So when you say memory, is it based on the way you usually talk about memories in computers? I mean, because a lot of research is actually going on about our human brain memory, that maybe it's not like a little box where you have something stored forever. It's actually more dynamic.
Yes.
And something is building when you have memory.
Yeah. So the thing is, I think we know already a lot, but there's still big gaps. We don't know exactly how memory is stored and how it all works in the in biological brain. So also in the computer, there are different approaches. Like some, they're basically like three different approaches that people follow right now. Some is storing experiences in the connections between neurons. Like if there's, for example, this rule, which we also observe in nature, it's called this Hebbian rule. If two synapses always fire together, then the connection between them gets stronger. So that's also something we're putting in these machines. And the other thing is that you can store kind of memory in the activation of these neurons. By having neurons that are connected to themselves, they can keep activation over multiple time steps. So that's called a recurrent neural network. That's also what they use. And then a new approach is that what people use now is that these machines have this external memory component, which is a little bit, it might not exactly work like this in biological brains, but it just works really well for these artificial brains. Mm-hmm. So even though the representation is more explicit in these, where you have an explicit external memory that it can write to and read from, it works really well. And ultimately, we might have a different kind of memory setup. But for the machines we are now, it gives them a lot more ability by giving them this external memory they can learn to read and write from, which we haven't been able to do with just like this Hebbian learning, for example. Mm-hmm. Like they can learn to solve more complex problems this way.
Okay.
Yeah, but it's a question: how similar is it to what we do in what humans do? The goal of my research is not to copy nature, but to more take inspiration and see what works well there, and can we somehow use this for our purposes? Not necessarily to have the most accurate like model of a brain. Mm. So what we have to find the right level of abstraction that works well, and it's also not too computationally expensive, because we don't want to simulate all the little channels you find in the brain, and that would be too expensive. Where I imagine this to work in the real world?
Yeah, these kind of thinking robots, where will they be used?
Yes, so I can definitely imagine, I mean, basically for all kinds of different tasks, ultimately, it would be good for robots to be more adaptive like they are now. For example, imagine you have a robot that you want to explore an environment without an autonomous robot without a human, like a disaster area that's too, for a human, would be too much danger to the human's life, or like a radioactive site. You want your robot to go there, and even if the robot, you know, loses a leg, you still want him to perform the task. And get better with each time it is employed in a certain situation. It should learn from its mistakes and should get better at these things. So that's why I imagine these robots could be helpful, like things that are too dangerous for us, areas you could send these robots that learn by themselves, that get better over time to perform a certain task. And that's definitely not where we are right now, because right now a lot of you need, for these algorithms to work, they need a lot of training data. Oftentimes they work in a supervised way, like all these current advances in AI, which there have been a lot of advances, but what makes them still different to how our brains work is you need a lot of examples. You need to show these machines like 1,000 examples of this is a car and this is a bike, and a kid, you show this one time, two times, and then it will learn what is what. So, and we also have the ability to get better over time by practicing, by doing things again and again, and that's also something that's missing from machines. So that's something we're working on. And then I think the application areas would be, you could even imagine space exploration, where you don't have somebody all the time controlling the robot. You want it to explore, you know, by itself, and not just if there's a one wheel is not working anymore, you can't just throw the robot away, but you need it needs to be able to adapt and to continue its mission, even if that happens. So I think there's a lot of application areas in these scenarios. People have been researching AI methods since, I'm not sure, probably like 60 years or longer probably. But there have been certain phases where AI was kind of hot, and then phases where, you know, interest died down. So over time there have been different, and especially with these, what is now really popular is these neural networks, like this deep learning, which is based on these simple models of brains. So there was a lot of hype initially with these networks, and then it died down again. Some people call this also the AI winter, because then there was not much progress and people were initially very excited, but then they couldn't make it work in the real world, for example, and not for certain tasks. So then it died down again. And then recently, like the last 4 or 5 years, there's a big push again, because they really have figured out how to make it work well for a lot of tasks that's also relevant for the industry. So currently this deep learning is really popular, which does not really involve this artificial evolution. But I think the next step would be to combine this deep learning, where people oftentimes hand design these networks. So they decide, okay, we need 3 layers here and 2 layers there and this layer there. But I think to scale up, we should combine this with artificial evolution to automate the design of these networks. So in deep learning, the only thing that gets trained currently in most approaches is the weights between neurons. But the human decides, I need 1,000 neurons here and 1,000 there. But that's something that I think we should also automate. So have artificial evolution design the structure, and then you have something like deep learning or other methods that could then optimize it, the connections between them. So I think ultimately it's going to, these two fields will kind of merge. And that's also why I think we need more and more computational resources, because deep learning is already expensive. And then evolution is kind of like an outer loop. So you have this deep learning, and then you have evolution on top. And that just requires a lot of computational resources to run both things in parallel.
So is that a limiting factor at the moment, the computational resources?
It's definitely, I mean, for us, it's always good to have more resources. Yeah. So, it has been a little, now it's getting better, but before it was definitely that we always had to make sure that if you want to combine evolution and something like deep learning, imagine in deep learning, sometimes these networks train, it takes them a few days to train. If you run evolution on top of this, you need, that requires 1 million evaluations. Like you have to evaluate 1 million individuals to get something good. Imagine like 1 million times a few days, that would be how long it will take to train. So there's still a bottleneck there. We just need to scale our experiments, I think, to involving more cores and more GPUs, and which also requires some engineering effort, because you need to parallelize how you run the experiments as well.
Mm-hmm. And can you do that at Abacus?
Yes, we can do that. And that's also something we're working on now, like scaling to more. So now that we have shown they work in these simple environments, we want to try to scale up and to more cores and just larger experiments running for longer as well. Yeah, so that's definitely something we're looking at now. And yeah.
So when did you start using supercomputers in your research?
So during my PhD, we had like a smaller cluster, and then we had some experiments with the Amazon. They also have some like clusters that you can use, and then we started using the Abacus. Maybe it's like 1.5 years ago, something mm-hmm. like this. And yeah, that definitely helped. Also, that it's pretty easy to administer, and it's definitely also more. It's not as costly. It's a good. You get a good performance for what you pay. Whereas Amazon, I think, would be more expensive mm-hmm. than when we use the Abacus. So that's good for us.
Do you think we need a national supercomputing resources, a national strategy for how research should be supported by supercomputing resources?
I think that would definitely be great, and I think it's great that Denmark has this resource like the Abacus, because it definitely makes our life a lot easier to have it. So I think it's great, and I think that's definitely something to invest in the future, like making this even more prominent, because I think that's what will also determine, like, competing with other countries and competing with other countries and companies. Like, all these companies like Google, they have so many computational resources, and it allows them also now to do like the most cutting edge research. So I think we also have to have the same here, and so I think we need to also expand on it, and I think it's good that there's this initiative, which really I think we need to be able to stay competitive.
So what are you working on right now? Do you have any project running in Abacus?
Yes, so we have this which is also a project that's co-funded by the EU, where we're trying to evolve plant robot hybrids. So that's something that's actually running right now, where we have some simulations where we're trying to evolve structures, robot structures that can work together, for example, with plants in the real world, plant structures. Uh-huh. So that's a EU project that we're trying to make plant robot hybrids.
Okay.
And for this, you need to kind of have robots, you know, that can interact together with plants to make like a symbiotic relationship. And right now we're having some evolutionary experiments, you know, what type of robots would evolve if they have to interact, for example, together with plants. And so that's something you could test in a simulation, and then you can build the best robots that you find in the simulation in the real world. And that's mm-hmm. something that's running right now.
But in what ways can these robots interact with the plants?
So one way is, for example, they can. So the idea behind this Flow Robotica project, which is like it's a large EU project with multiple partners. One idea is to robots are good because you can control them. Plants, on the other hand, are good because they can grow and they can generate new material, which a robot cannot do. And so one way that the robot interacts with the plant is it can, for example, send light signals or distribute hormones that tell the plant where it has to grow. Mm-hmm. And so we're exploring like what kind of interaction can you do with these two things, so they can kind of combine the advantages of both of plants and robots together. Mm-hmm. And that's something that's running right now. And then I also we're going to start experiments soon with this, where you have this external memory, which we call evolving neural Turing machines. And that's another experiment that we're going to, where we're going to scale it up, I presented this last week at the conference, and now we're going to scale it up to more complex tasks, and where the robots also have to, you know, learn to work from higher dimensional input. So oftentimes in these initial experiments, we directly tell the robot, okay, there's these and these things are present in the world. But then the next thing is to allow them to learn, for example, from raw visual feedback. Instead of telling them which are the objects, they have to manually figure out, you know, what are the different objects and how can they be combined. So that's something we're also going to start soon as well. Mm-hmm. And then other people in our robotics evolution and art lab, they're also working on determining not just the, for example, the brains of these robots, but also the morphology. So what is the best what is the best morphology of these robots, and then you can make the these morphology, for example, through 3D printing, also in the so you can transfer it to the real world, the best morphology that is found in some simulation. So we're trying to evolve both, like the body and the brain, of these things together, ultimately, because that's also how it works in nature. Like the brains are specifically tailored to the body, and they exploit the body to do certain forms of computation. So certain things are easier because of the morphology that like certain animals have.
In your robots, are the brains still located somewhere isolated from the body?
Yes. So normally, so currently, there oftentimes you have a desktop computer, and then that computer communicates with the, for example, the robot. We also have approaches where we have the whole kind of brain on like Raspberry Pi, like computers that you can that are integrated in the machine. But to do more computationally expensive things, you still often need an external machine that processes all the information and then sends back to the robot what it should do, like go left, right. And it gets the sensory feedback from the robot, like through a camera, and then it processes information, and then it sends it back, and then the robot does what it should do. But it ultimately would be ideal if you have, I mean, at some point it would be great to integrate everything, but that's not the hardest step, I think. Once you know how it works, then you can always make things smaller and, yeah.
So where would you like to take your research? If you look like 5 or 10 years ahead, do you have any ideas where it could be really cool to go?
Right. Yeah, I mean, I definitely would like to make machines that can do this lifelong learning and that can evolve with us. Like I imagine some, you know, like you can imagine a kindergarten for robots where you have, you know, they grow up, you teach them new skills, they get better and better instead of, I think that might be the future. Instead of trying to train them everything at once, you need to make a machine that can, you need to learn to learn. So that's what I would like to make, computers that learn the ability to learn, and then they can learn new things and yeah, grow up to learn all kinds of things. They're not so I think it would be great having machines that are not programmed for a specific task, like what all the machines right now are programmed for a specific task. So you have one machine that learns to play Go, and one that learns to play chess, and other ones that are good at, you know, healthcare diagnostics. But I think it would be great if you can teach this machine anything, like you can teach us. Like you can teach somebody to learn Chinese if they're a kid, or English. So there's no limit, or they can learn chess. So that, I think that's something, making really machines that can learn during their life all kinds of new things and learn from experience, which you don't, basically they don't exist right now. So I think that would be a great goal if we have that, to work on that. And then the other thing I think is really important. So we live in this society where everything is automated or everything starts to be automated. And so one important thing for me is also, can we make things that work together with machines? Like can you combine the best ideas of robots and humans to come up with solutions for important problems quicker than each one could by themselves? So I'm interested in this, what I call like hybrid intelligence, where you have a computer that gives suggestions, the human gives suggestions, and together you reach a solution to a problem by collaborating instead of just automating everything, only having AI. I think that will also be an important future research direction, having humans and machines work together to solve problems we can't solve by ourselves.